Hello, folks. Welcome to the November 2017 edition of First Thursday. This is the Labor Relations Information Systems monthly podcast on recent developments in public safety labor issues. This is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or so as we cover, this time, a potpourri of topics that have come up over the course of the last month or so. I want to talk about those amazing raises that we're seeing out of California this year, some huge double-digit raises and what seems to be behind all of them. I also have a Graham versus Connor case that I think is important to talk about, a pretty big past practice case that I think illustrates a number of good principles about past practice, and also the difficulty that public safety officers have in filing stress claims under workers' compensation. But before I start any of that, I just want to do a couple of administrative things. The first is I want to remind everybody, go to iTunes if you like this podcast. Let Apple know. It turns out that the most important metric that iTunes uses to determine which programs get featured where in its podcast directory is user reviews. Every review helps. You know, there's like a jillion podcasts now. And so even one or two or three or five reviews helps put us up there somewhere in the Apple scale of things. Do a search for Labor Relations Information System in podcast. You can select the podcast and leave us a review. Also, I hope everybody's recovered from that amazing interview that we had last month with an economist from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And I know there's probably nothing more exciting than getting down into the weeds and talking about how the consumer price index is constructed. Actually, though, you know, if you haven't listened to that podcast, it's worth doing. Steve Reed, who was the BLS economist that I interviewed, turned out to be a fantastic guest and did a wonderful job of deconstructing the consumer price index, why it is some of these indices are going to be going away on January 1st, 2018, why it is others of the indices, you know, like the major four major regional indices are going to be changed. And most importantly, Steve even had some advice on what we do about it. If you have, for example, a collective bargaining agreement or an MOU that is tied into one of these CPIs that is either going to be going away or is going to be substantially modified, what are your options with respect to a substitute index or renegotiating the wage escalator clause in your collective bargaining agreement? Any rate, great conversation. I very much appreciated it. And if you've got any CPI issues, it's well worth spending the 20 minutes on. Okay, let's talk about those California raises. There have been three of them in large cities this year that have been among the largest raises I have ever seen anywhere in any public safety agency. It started off in January of this year. It started off down in San Jose with the San Jose Police Department. They negotiated a 3.5-year, if memory serves me right, I think it's 3.5-year contract with a 20% wage increase. Part of it was in across-the-board wages, and part of it was in an unusual form of compensation where officers who go through a critical incident training will receive eventually a little bit north of a 3% premium pay. And, of course, just about 100% of the officers in the bargaining unit there will receive critical incident training and will receive a little bit north of a 3% premium pay. The second raise that we saw was in Sacramento. It was another 20% raise over several years, and this too had some unusual features in it, but mostly it was just simply across-the-board wage increases. And then the big one that just came down in the last couple of weeks or so in San Diego, another police wage. All three of these are police wage increases. San Diego, the city of San Diego and the Police Officers Association down there basically agreed to kind of tear up the end of their contract and put an extension on it, a three-year extension on it, 30%. 30% wage increase. Wow. At a time when the cost of living is running a little bit less than 2%, these double-digit wage increases are really amazing. So what's the common thread in all three of these jurisdictions? Well, it turns out there's several. First of all, in all three, they have come off of years of either wage freezes or benefit cuts. And the other common thread is all three simply couldn't recruit and retain police officers. San Jose, over the course of about a three-year period of time, was down more than 300 officers. Not because it didn't have the positions available, it just simply couldn't fill them. Officers were, for a time period there, seemingly fleeing the San Jose Police Department, taking jobs in suburban agencies around the Bay Area, and officers weren't signing up to hire on to become new police officers. Same is true in Sacramento, and then in San Diego. San Diego has almost been kind of the poster child for the recruitment and retention problem around the country. San Diego has been laboring under a voter-approved pay freeze for many, many years, multi-year wage freezes. They have a high copayment on medical insurance. They have a high employee contribution to retirement, to the retirement plan. There have been voter-approved initiatives to change a retirement plan. It's really a mess, and it's a mess where there's been a political movement down there in San Diego that has focused on attacking public employees. And it's not like the city is broke. The city of San Diego actually has a pretty good economic base, actually a very good one compared to many cities in this country. It was rather this political philosophy that public safety employees, public employees in general, but in particular public safety employees, were overpaid. All three of these cities paid the price for those wage freezes to the point where they not only weren't able to recruit and retain, what they were doing was changing the demographic makeup of their police departments, because people that they might well wanted to have targeted to hire on simply in this economy had way too many other employment opportunities and they weren't taking the jobs. What impact is this going to have? Well, it's I think very, very difficult to imagine that it won't have an impact in California, particularly among large cities in California, right? I mean, these are the jurisdictions that have been used to compare to cities such as the Anaheims and San Diego's and Oakland's that are down there, Long Beach, another one. It's hard to imagine that it's not going to have a ripple effect, because all of a sudden, Sacramento and San Jose and San Diego have become meaningful competitors in the wage market, where they simply weren't before. Will it go beyond the borders of California? Maybe not. It might impact some large cities around the country, but it's, I think, more likely to be confined to California, at least for the nonce, right? But you know one thing we've seen over the years in public safety wage negotiations is what happens with police or with firefighters is eventually going to happen in some measure with the other group. If there's big wage increases on the fire side, eventually you're going to see them on the police side. And we also have seen many times that what happens in California tends to be a precursor of what happens around the country two or three or four years later. So these big increases that we're seeing, increases that, boy, it's hard to see how they're not going to have to be, maybe not matched, but somewhere in the ballpark approximated by other jurisdictions in California. These increases may go beyond the border of California and have the impact of changing the wages and benefits structure in the country. And you know what? At least for law enforcement right now, where we have a nationwide recruitment and retention problem, maybe it's time, right? You've got recruitment issues not just in California. You have them where I'm recording this podcast, in Portland. You have them up in Anchorage. You have them in Portland, Maine. You have them in Florida. They're all over the place. And it's because I think of a very basic change in the nature of the police officer's job and the fact that applicants are voting with their feet as to whether or not they want that career. And when you have a shortage of supply, go back to economics 101, when you have a shortage of supply, what do? You're able to increase the price. And I think we're going to see that upper pressure on wages. And that's consequential, right? Because we don't have that upper pressure on tax revenues. And what you may well see is that public safety agencies are going to be consuming a greater and greater percent of county and city budgets. It's early yet, but these sorts of numbers, and it's kind of similar, maybe not quite as high, but similar numbers in smaller jurisdictions, this is getting to be pretty significant. Okay, let's get into those, or that potpourri of cases that I wanted to talk about this month. And let's start with the workers' compensation stress case. One thing that happened a number of years ago, in many states it was in the 80s, and some states it kind of slopped over into the 90s, was a cutback in the circumstances under which a stress claim could be considered for workers' compensation purposes. In some states, that restriction of workers' compensation benefits or pension benefits occurred as a matter of legislative action, where you'd see it come from a state legislature, for example. In other places, the cutback was the product of court decisions. And the impact of that has been that for public safety employees, it's become, in many states, almost impossible to file stress claims. There's a lot of different standards that are out there. Perhaps the most difficult of them is one where, in order to prove any sort of stress claim, the employee also has to prove a physical injury, that the stress claim arose out of a physical injury that was suffered on the job. So, for example, in a law enforcement context, an officer claiming post-traumatic stress disorder from being involved in an officer-involved shooting might have to show that they, in fact, were shot as well as the suspect. There you would have the physical injury, or that a firefighter who is filing a claim for, say, depression or anxiety attacks, would have to show that all of that started during a fire in which they were injured. That's a very difficult standard, makes it almost impossible. There's a slightly easier standard, although I use the word easier guardedly because this one's almost impossible as well, that is illustrated by a Wisconsin case that came down in the last month or so. And let's talk a little bit about the case and then what the standard is going to be. This case comes out of the town of Grand Chute, Wisconsin. Grand Chute, Wisconsin, I think this is kind of important, only has about 20,000 people in it. And one of the patrol officers working for the police department there was Officer Linda Burt Redding. And in 2002, while she was working, she shot an individual who belonged to a street gang. The individual that she shot was threatening motorists, was wielding a knife, and the shooting was determined by the department to be justified. After the shooting, Burt Redding began to receive threats. And the threats fell into roughly three categories. And the threats were coming from probably members of the shooting victim's family. In fact, the record is clear. In some cases, that's who the threats came from. And may have come from gang members as well. The three categories of threats that she received, the first category were threats that were made directly to her on her life. The second were threats made to her son, and the third were threats made to the police department, where the department received the threats through some means or another that the shooting victim's family was threatening Burt Redding's life. Eventually, Burt Redding files a workers' compensation claim, and the basis of her claim are the threats, or was the threats against her life, and not only that she suffered from chronic depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and actually had anxiety attacks relating to the job and the possibility that her life would be at risk. When she files this workers' compensation claim, the city denies it, goes up to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, which also denies the claim. Why, you might wonder. This is a clear case of stress. No one disputes that Burt Redding has had depression and the anxiety attacks. No one seems to contest that psychological difficulties that she's suffering made her unable to perform her job. It's all work-related, right? Why is the court denying workers' compensation coverage? And it's because of the test that is used for stress cases in Wisconsin. And this is a test that's used in a variety of other states. And this test is that in order to make a claim for a non-traumatic disability, in other words, a mental or a psychological disability, the employee must show extraordinary stress. What does that mean? The court says the mental injury must have resulted from a situation, and I'm quoting now, of greater dimensions than the day-to-day emotional strain and tension that similarly situated employees must experience. So in other words, in Burt Redding's case, you look at the universe of police officers and you decide whether or not the strain and tension that she suffered as a result of these threats made to her and her son and the department, whether that's beyond the norm in law enforcement. And the court says it's not. Police chief testified that the threats received by Burt Redding were, and this is a quote from the police chief's testimony, not unusual or atypical for a police officer. The city apparently called an expert witness, a police science instructor by the name of Robert Willis. I haven't encountered him yet, so I don't know what his specialty is. But he testified that the threats were, his words, not unusual, nor should be considered atypical to the law enforcement profession. Willis went further and said these sorts of threats are common, and the possibility of threats just goes with the job. So the court says these are not unusual for law enforcement, these threats. Therefore, we don't have the sort of extraordinary stress that you need in order to support a PTSD and anxiety attack claim for workers' compensation. Now look, you may debate the testimony of the police chief and the expert, and you know, from 1,500 miles away, I certainly do, right? Is it normal for a police chief to get, a police officer to get death threats relayed through their son or daughter? I don't think that's a normal part of a police officer's job. So, you know, we may carp a little bit at the facts here and the evidence, but the evidence was submitted in the record. what we really ought to be focusing on is that test, right? The extraordinary stress test, because it makes it virtually impossible for a police officer in Wisconsin or any of the other states that have this sort of test, makes it virtually impossible for them to ever file a stress claim. And stress claims can be disabling. Since this test was created, the Americans with Disabilities Act was amended by the United States Congress. And under the ADA now, post-traumatic stress disorder is presumptively a disability under the law. So I use this case really just as a reminder to all of you who are listening to this, that if this is an issue that concerns you, the extent of workers' compensation laws and whether they can or should cover stress claims, you need to be looking at the standards in your state. You need to be thinking about whether or not some sort of legislative action, perhaps joint labor management legislative action, is necessary in order to make the courts more hospitable towards these sorts of claims. Let's move on to Alabama, and I want to talk about a First Amendment case that comes out of a police department, small police department, Anniston, Alabama Police Department. This case is interesting, I think, because it raises a critical distinction about the First Amendment, and that is there's a difference in terms of how protected activity is if you're just joining a group, as opposed to not only joining the group, but engaging in speech beyond simply joining the group. And this is a thread in public safety case law that actually goes back 30, 40 years. There used to be a number of cases involving officers, police officers, and there's a corrections case out of Florida, who were members of the Ku Klux Klan. And these are cases, I think they're all out of the 1980s. And you saw the courts make this distinction between, are they just a member of the KKK, or are they actually doing something to promote the KKK and tying it into their job? And we saw a few of those cases, and then we stopped seeing them, maybe because the KKK seemed to largely go away. Of course, you know, now it's back, right? Well, this isn't the KKK in this case. This is a group that's known as the League of the South, and it involves a lieutenant in the Anniston Police Department by the name of Josh Dogrell. So what's the League of the South? I'd never heard of it. I had to look it up. The League of the South's stated purpose is to, and I'm quoting, advance the cultural, social, economic, and political well-being and independence of the Southern people by all honorable means. That's okay, right? Nothing wrong with that. And it'd be nice if we had like a League of the Pacific Northwest, but I don't think we do. But here's where it gets a little dicey. According to the president of the League of the South, Southern people, the group of people that this the league is designed to advance, is only white people of Southern heritage. Black Southerners are not eligible to be included within the concept of Southern people as defined by the League. Well, Dogrell, the lieutenant, has been a firmly committed of the League, member of the League of the South for his entire adult life. He started a local chapter of the League of the South in 2009 after he'd become a police officer. The local paper, the Anniston Star, published an article about Dogrell's formation of the chapter. He was sharp enough, at least at that point, to ask the reporter not to identify him as a police officer. The reporter complied with that, but nonetheless, the city received a citizen's complaint criticizing Dogrell's involvement in the League of the South. But it all kind of blew over. It blew over because the police chief, who was then the interim city manager, did a little bit of an investigation and decided that simple membership in the League of the South was not a violation of the police department's rules. The department warned Dockrell to be very careful not to mix his association in the league with the department, and everything moved on. That was 2009. Lasted 4 years. And then in 2013, Dockrell speaks at the league's annual national conference and gives a speech that is entitled Cultivating the Goodwill of Police Officers. Dockrell identifies himself as an Anniston police officer. Okay, problems starting now, right? And he says these things, and these are all quotes. Police officers are the kind of people we need in this kind of organization. These are the truly successful ones that can be counted on to be a warrior in the battles that come. He also identifies another Anniston Police Department lieutenant who's present at this convention, a guy named Wayne Brown. And he's saying, you know, I talked to Brown on the way, and Brown asked me on the way to the convention, he asked me, what would arouse our people to see exactly what was happening to them and what is the necessary step for succession? And Dockrell said, I told Brown, that's not only a good question, but perhaps the million-dollar one. He goes on, as if that's not enough. Dockrell says, the vast majority of men in uniform are aware that they are Southerners, and kith and kin comes before illegal national mandates. He says things like, it's wonderful to go and show my bosses all the radicals I was cavorting with on the weekends, and then talks about an internal affairs investigation into that was prompted by a gentleman he describes as a small town, Jesse Jackson. Well, I can go on and on and on. You get the drift of what he's doing. Needless to say, there's a bit of a public outcry. And the public outcry is spearheaded by the Southern Poverty Law Center that published an article entitled Anniston Police Department Has Two Hate Group Members on the Force. The city gets a number of media requests, not just local, but national and international media requests to talk about the whole thing. It had to shut down its Facebook page because of the extraordinary and vituperative social media reaction and debate over the issue. That was important to the department because its Facebook account had 27,000 followers and served as kind of a lifeline between the department and the community in different ways. Dockrell, wanting to not leave well enough alone, puts an image on his own personal Facebook page of a white not equal sign against a black background, and this is a sign, given the way it's described in the court's opinion, that conveyed that blacks and whites are not equal. Surprise, the city fires Dockrell. That wouldn't be a surprise anywhere in the country, but in Alabama, you know, there's no police unions in Alabama, and it's not like police officers have a lot of rights to their job. Dockrell, though, does file a First Amendment lawsuit, and he contends that his freedom of association, his ability to join this league, his freedom of association had been violated. Federal court disagrees and says to Dockrell, it's not your association in the group. It is not merely your membership, which costs you your job here. It's your speech. To be sure, your membership is, when you chose to make it public, your membership poses the department an awful lot of problems. The League of the South, as the court describes it, promotes a return to segregation, overtly disparages black Americans, believes in white supremacy and the inferiority of black Americans, and espouses plainly racist and inflammatory rhetoric. So to be sure, that causes a problem. But then you disregarded the warning the department gave you not to publicly associate yourself. You did it by giving a speech at this national conference. You tied your speech into law enforcement, and you specifically indicated that another member of the department believed the same sort of things that you did. What you did was to cause a public outcry, attributable not just to your membership, but to your speech. And when you did that, you crossed the line. And here's the tagline on the court's opinion. Doggerel's speech was not protected because his interest in speaking out was outweighed by the department's interests in maintaining order, loyalty, morale, and harmony within the department and throughout the community. Prior to his termination, Doggerel was given the opportunity to denounce the League of the South and reduce some of the community-wide tension caused by his speech. He declined to do so. So, this is an opinion that really, as I started off this discussion with, harkens back about 30 years. We've seen this, you know, time and time again, where membership in one of these groups, whatever the group is, membership alone may not be the basis upon which to discipline a public safety employee, but taking it beyond mere membership can be. I want to wind up this podcast by talking for a little while, actually, about a very important concept in collective bargaining. I touch on it from time to time, but there's this case out of New York involving the city of Albany, New York, that has such great facts that I think it's a great vehicle to talk about this incredibly important concept. So where collective bargaining exists, that there's generally an obligation to negotiate over wages, hours, and some wording of terms and conditions of employment. Those are the things that are the phrase you normally see is mandatorily negotiable, mandatory subjects of bargaining. This duty to bargain occurs really in two entirely different contexts. One context is what you normally expect, which is when a collective bargaining agreement expires and the union and management sits down at the table, then there's an obligation to bargain over anything that's mandatory for bargaining, a wage or an hour or hours issue or a working conditions issue. That's the common context in which we think of this duty to bargain. However, there is a continuing nature of the duty to bargain. In fact, it's often called the continuing duty to bargain. Sometimes it's referred to as the status quo rule. Sometimes it's referred to, and this is hearkening to a U.S. Supreme Court decision with the same name, as the Katz, K-A-T-Z, doctrine. All of that is simply a different way of describing the same thing. And what is being described is that if something is mandatory for bargaining, if it falls within what's ever negotiable under your state law or your local bargaining ordinance, whatever it might be, if it's mandatory for bargaining, the employer may not make a change in the past practice in the area unless the union has waived the right to bargain over the change. So, in other words, this is a restriction, the continuing duty to bargain, is a restriction on the employer's ability to change past practices. Now, the employer may have the ability to make those changes under a collective bargaining agreement. That's what I mean when I say unless the union has waived the right to bargain over the change. It could well be you have a contract clause that says the employer can make a change in this area, whatever it is. For example, there are some collective bargaining agreements, fire department collective bargaining agreements, that give the employer the ability to change starting times. Well, starting times, that's an hours of work issue. That's ordinarily mandatorily negotiable. And ordinarily, the continuing duty to bargain would say that the employer couldn't make a change in starting times without negotiating with the union. But if you have a contract clause, that gives the employer the right to make changes in starting times, then you have a waiver of the continuing duty to bargain. Where do you see the action over waivers of the continuing duty to bargain? It's what a management rights clause is, right? Or at least it's an attempt on the part of an employer to get the union to waive the ability to challenge changes in past practices. In fact, that's really all a management rights clause is a waiver of the continuing duty to bargain. So if you open up your collective bargaining agreement and you look at Article 2 or 3, and that's normally where management rights clauses are, is like Articles 2 or 3 for whatever reason, and you see it shall be the exclusive function of management to do these things, and the union has no right to protest changes in this area, and then you see the list, and the list could be 1, 2, and 3, or the list could be 1 through 25, whatever that list is, that's an attempt to get the union to waive its rights to protest changes in past practices. Now, the key here about this continuing duty to bargain, or one of many keys, is that it concerns topics that are typically not addressed in the collective bargaining agreement, right? If whatever this topic is covered in the collective bargaining agreement, then the contract's going to dictate whether or not management can make a change in this area. Rather, the continuing duty to bargain most often applies to topics that aren't specifically discussed in a collective bargaining agreement. And what the continuing duty to bargain says is if those topics, whatever they are mandatory for bargaining under the law, then the employer can't make a change in that area, even though the contract is completely silent on the issue. A couple of times this year, I've talked about state Supreme Courts addressing changes in residency rules. That's one of the kind of classic continuing duty to bargain topics, because very few collective bargaining agreements actually talk about residency rules. But it's also thought, residency is thought, I think almost universally, to be a mandatory subject of bargaining. So when you get this litigation over residency rules, what these courts are saying is, look, if residency is a mandatory subject of bargaining, the employer can't make a change in that area, even if it does so through a charter change. Can't make a change in that area without first negotiating with the union, even though the contract is completely silent on the issue of residency. Instead, what courts are saying, the analysis is, let's take a look. It's a two-part analysis. Is this, whatever this is, a mandatorily negotiable subject? And if it is, has the union established that there's a past practice in the area? And if it has, then the employer's going to have to bargain over that change unless the union has waived the right to bargain. Now, before I drill down into the facts of this case out of Albany, I want to add a couple more fine touches on this continuing duty to bargain. First of all, what does negotiate mean? Several times already, I've said the continuing duty to bargain means that an employer has to negotiate over changes in past practices. What does negotiate mean? It means whatever it means in your state. So there are 38 states in the country where there are statewide public safety employee collective bargaining laws, 39 if you count Idaho, which allows bargaining just for firefighters, but there's no statewide law covering police. But let's say there's 38 that have it for both police, fire, and corrections, or all three. Most of those states, negotiate means if you can't reach an agreement, you end up in binding arbitration, where an arbitrator, what's known as an interest arbitrator, has the ability to dictate whatever the terms of that mandatory subject of bargaining will be. By my count, 32 of the 38 states have binding arbitration as the last step in the bargaining process. Different forms of bargaining, binding arbitration. There may be last best offer, or as it's known sometimes, baseball arbitration. Different forms, but the majority of states, the vast majority of states, end their bargaining with binding arbitration for public safety employees. There's some notable exceptions that are large states, Florida and California, generally end their bargaining with what's known as a meet and confer process, where the employer can, if you get to impasse, unilaterally implement its last best offer. But the bottom line is, when I'm talking about the continuing duty to bargain, and I'm saying the employer has the obligation to negotiate over changes in past practice, most places, what I'm saying is, if you can't reach an agreement, then that change in past practice ends up in arbitration. In the meet and confer states, it ends up with mediation, usually, and in some states, a fact-finding, or Florida, a special master kind of process, and eventually ends with the employer being able to unilaterally implement its last best offer. So most places, arbitration. Some places, employer can eventually unilaterally implement. The second fine point I want to put on this continuing duty to bargain is that the employer has to bargain before it makes the change. So it cannot implement the change and then go ahead and bargain afterwards. Instead, the bargaining obligation, even the obligation to bargain about the effects of the change, the usual rule is, bargaining must occur prior to implementation. The third kind of fine point that I want to put on this is, what happens if, I know I'm loading up all these fine points, I keep thinking about them. So what happens if the employer unilaterally implements without bargaining and is found to have had an obligation to bargain? Well, the answer is that a labor board customarily will order the restoration of the past practice and will also order that employees be made whole for any lost wages and benefits in the interim. And the fourth, and I promise, final, fine point that I want to put on all this, I talked about what a management rights clause is and how a management rights clause really focuses on this continuing duty to bargain and focuses on trying to get waivers, that trying to say in a management rights clause that the employer has the ability to do this and that and the other thing. There's another contract clause that's in some many collective bargaining agreements that focuses on the continuing duty to bargain, and this is a maintenance of benefits clause, MOB clause. Sometimes it's called maintenance of standards, sometimes it's called existing conditions, but these clauses all say roughly the same thing, and what they say is that all wages, hours, and mandatorily negotiable working conditions have to be maintained at no less the level that's in effect as of the time of the signing of the contract. So what's that? How does that relate to this notion of a continuing duty to bargain? So if you think of a management rights clause as an evisceration of the continuing duty to bargain, an elimination of the obligation to bargain over certain topics, think of a maintenance of benefits clause as the continuing duty to bargain on steroids, if you will. So where the continuing duty to bargain says to an employer, look, you can't change past practices without bargaining, what a maintenance of benefits clause says is, if you've got one in your collective bargaining agreement, you can't change past practices, period. employer, you don't have the ability to come to the union under a maintenance and benefits clause and reopen the contract on a particular topic. You can ask. You can say, hey, we would like to change, for example, the residency rule, or we want to have a new tattoo policy, or we want to implement body cameras, or, you know, whatever it might be. You can ask the union. But hearkening back to Nancy Reagan, the union has the right to just say no. Under a maintenance of benefits clause, the union has the ability to say to the employer, yeah, we know you want to make this change in a mandatory subject to bargaining. Come back to us when the contract is next open for negotiations. So that's all background here, right? That's what the continuing duty to bargain is, and that's how management rights clauses play into it, and that's how a maintenance of benefits clause plays into this continuing duty to bargain. So now let's finally get to the topic of this discussion, which is this Albany case that comes out of what's known as the appellate division. That's the intermediate court of appeals in the New York court system. The New York court system has kind of unusual names, unique names, I think. Pretty much in the country for its court system. The Supreme Court in New York is actually the trial court in New York. And what's called the Court of Appeals in New York is actually what we would call the Supreme Court in other states. And the appellate division is the intermediate, what's in between trial courts and the Court of Appeals in New York. And this is a case involving a decision from New York's Public Employment Relations Board. That's the PERB is the administrative agency that's charged with the responsibility of dealing with the collective bargaining laws in New York. This is an appeal of a PERB decision as to whether or not an employer had to bargain over a change in past practice. What's the past practice here? The city of Albany has consistently reimbursed active members or members of, in this case, it's the Albany Police Officers Union, but it could be any union, consistently reimbursed them post-retirement for their Medicare Part B monthly premiums. So this is a part of the Medicare program, and this Part B, if you haven't gotten there yet, where you have to be thinking about what in the world Part B is, this is kind of a supplemental Medicare benefit, and employees typically, or retirees typically, are on the hook for paying the Part B premiums. But in Albany, there'd been a historic past practice where the city had done that. If so once you retired, if you were a police officer, and I guess the union, the police officers union in Albany represents not just officers but other employees, if you're a union retiree, the city would reimburse for the monthly premiums. And that had been going on for years and years and years, by the court's opinion, at least 20 years. Well, in October 2008, the city sends a notice to retirees of changes in its different health plans. And with regard to the Medicare Part B reimbursement, the October 2008 notice said, under the city's current policy, I'll come back to those words, under the city's current policy, the city will reimburse you the Medicare Part B premium on a monthly basis. There was a separate notice sent out on the same date to active employees that described various changes in the city's health plans, but didn't say anything at all about the Medicare Part B reimbursements. So tuck that phrase away in the back of your head as we go through this case. What the city's notice is saying is, under the city's, and here comes the important word, current policy, the city will reimburse Medicare Part B premiums. Okay, fast forward another year, October 2009, which sounds like it's an open enrollment announcement. The city sends a notice to all retirees advising them of more changes to the health plans and says, as of December 31, 2009, we're not going to be reimbursing medical Part B premiums to those who became eligible for Medicare on January 1, 2010 or later. The similar notice that went out to active employees advised them of the changes in the health plan, but again, omitted any reference to this change in Medicare Part B premium reimbursements. The union files an unfair labor practice complaint. In New York, those are called improper practice charges. And the union is saying the discontinuance of the Medicare Part B premium reimbursements is a violation of the continuing duty to bargain. PERB rejects the complaint. PERB says the union failed to establish the necessary past practice of reimbursements. And the union challenges this in this intermediate court of appeals. Union has an uphill battle because in New York, the standard of review in of PERB decisions is whether or not there is a rational basis for PERB's determination. Now, that rational basis test, if you haven't encountered it yet, what it means is PERB doesn't have to be right. It just has to have a rational basis for its decision. It could well be the court would say, hey, you know, we'd come out with a different result here, but PERB had a rational basis, so we're duty-bound to uphold its opinion. That's how the rational basis test works. And the court finds that the city fails it. The court finds that PERB's decision isn't rational with respect to the past practice. And the court, you know, starts it out with a classic discussion of what a past practice is. Court says it depends on whether or not this practice of Medicare Part B premium reimbursement, whether or not it was unequivocal and continued uninterrupted for a period of time, whether or not the past practice created a reasonable expectation among employees that it would continue. And the court says, yeah, that's exactly what we have here. The city's been reimbursing the retirees for over 20 years. That's a long enough duration. That's unequivocal enough. Several witnesses, the court says, testified about their understanding and expectation that this would be a lifetime benefit. One witness even testified that in bargaining with the city, the topic of reimbursement of Medicare Part B premiums was raised, but the city said, yeah, we're doing it. No need to formalize that and put it into the contract because we all know it's going to last forever. And the court says that is enough of a past practice, and that is unequivocal enough that the city can't change that without first bargaining. Now, let's come back to under the city's current policy, because the city is arguing that the notice that it sent that in October of 2008, the city argued that that phrase under the current policy is essentially a reservation of rights that the city had the ability to change the policy at any time. This is just our current policy. It may not be our policy in the future, is implied, as the city's argument goes. And the court says, no, you know what? We need more evidence of that sort of waiver than that. Here's what the court's opinion, or the way it ends, and I'm going to quote a couple of sentences here. That phrase, those five words, do not constitute substantial evidence connoting either the absence of a past practice of reimbursing these premiums, especially where the record as a whole demonstrates that there was a continual reimbursement of retirees for a significant period of time. It doesn't connote either the absence of that past practice or that such practice would only be temporary. Instead, it simply is a description of the policy. If we're going to have a waiver, It's got to be more specific than that. It would have to say something like, and the union would have to agree to it, it would have to say something like, the city reserves the right to discontinue Medicare Part B premium reimbursements. So the court ends up annulling the decision of PIRB, sends it back to PIRB for a decision on the remedy. It's pretty easy to predict what the remedy is going to be there. It's going to be whatever the Part B premiums were for retirees, and very likely with interest. And where the remedy might get a little bit odd is what happens as a result of not having Medicare Part B insurance because the retiree couldn't afford to pay for it. What if the retiree was subjected to all sorts of co-payments and additional medical charges? Probably the remedy would include that as well. Now, one thing I do want to close with on this that the court doesn't talk about is this is a benefit that's being changed for retirees. Why does the union have any right to file an unfair labor practice over that? It's not affecting active members. And the way that the law is in New York, and it's this way in almost all states, is that if this benefit is promised as part of active employment, the union has the right to enforce it both on behalf of its current members who would someday get the benefit and also on behalf of its former members who are now eligible for the benefit. So, interesting case. I don't think I've ever seen one on Medicare Part B premiums. And I think it really serves as a good illustration of some of these basic principles of the continuing duty to bargain. Okay, with that, I need to wind it up. I'm headed toward my witching hour here. I try to keep all of these podcasts under an hour. I want to thank you all for listening to the podcast. It's great. I hear comments from you sometimes, and it's really heartening to know that people are listening and are interested in these topics that really fascinate me on an ongoing basis. I want to remind you that we've got some seminars coming up. Go to LRIS.com to check them out. In particular, we have a collective bargaining for fire and police and corrections. That's a seminar where we invite management and labor to. That's coming up in April in Las Vegas. And we hope to that you join us in December for our next First Thursday podcast. This is Will Aitchison signing off.